I'm Bridget Armstrong, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Today, a conversation with New York Times journalist Helene Cooper about her latest book, Madam President, which chronicles the life of Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who in 2006 became the first woman to lead an African nation. When she was elected in 2005, the country had just come out of a brutal period of civil war. Now, as she nears the end of her tenure, we'll explore her legacy and talk about the women's movement that propelled her to the highest office in Liberia. Then, my conversation with bad feminist Roxane Gay about her latest collection of short stories, Difficult Women. Plus, we'll talk about her much-anticipated memoir, Hunger.
Hunger has been the most difficult book I've ever written.
A midday special edition is next, but first, the news. Welcome to a special edition of Midday. I'm Bridget Armstrong, filling in for Tom Hall. We won't be taking your calls today, but you are welcome to hop on over to WYPR's Facebook page and join the discussion. Today, a conversation with two women who write about women who dare to beat the odds and defy expectations. Later on in the program, I'll speak with Roxane Gay about her latest book, Difficult Women. But first, a conversation about Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. When she took office in 2006, she became the first woman to lead an African nation. Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Helene Cooper chronicles President Johnson Sirleaf's journey to the highest office in her new book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Life of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The book is as much about President Johnson Sirleaf's life as it is the culture that shaped her and the women who supported her. President Johnson Sirleaf was born between two worlds at odds in Liberia. Educated at Harvard University, she was determined to return home to help her country, a decision that often put her in danger. When she was elected in 2005, the country had just come out of a brutal period of civil war. Now, she's nearing the end of her tenure and plans to step down peacefully, the first president of Liberia to do so in decades. And Helene Cooper joins me now from her office in D.C. to talk about President Johnson Sirleaf's legacy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bridget.
President Johnson Sirleaf was born sort of in between these two levels of society in Liberia. The native Liberians and the so-called Congo people were often at odds, and it really sort of dates back to when freed slaves returned to the country. Can you kind of talk about that tension between the native Liberians and the Congo people and where Ellen Johnson Sirleaf fit into all of that and where her family fit in?
Well, Liberia was founded, as you know, in 1822 by freed American slaves who went back to Africa. And they were very courageous people, but they also set up the same kind of antebellum society that they had fled from in the American South, except now they were the elite, sort of lording it over everybody else, the native Africans in Liberia. And that sort of unbalanced system lasted for 150 years until 1980, when native Liberian soldiers with the military overthrew the government and took over. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is not a descendant of the slaves, but because her grandfather was German, she and her mother was native Liberian, she was able to, as you say, sort of float between two worlds. She was accepted in the descendant of the American slave society, and she was also, because her Golot roots, accepted in native Liberian society, which is really unusual in Liberia, but it really did allow her to kind of camouflage herself everywhere she went.
Right, and you kind of touched on that. It gave her a certain level of privilege that other native Liberians didn't have. She was educated. So much of this book is also about the culture that surrounded Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And, of course, I love your use of Liberian English throughout the book. And you tell about this prophecy that was given by an elder when she was born. And that prophecy kind of comes up a lot throughout the book. Do you mind sharing that story?
You know, Liberia is a very spiritual place. We all believe in spirits and voodoo and you name it, first of all, from Liberia, so I can say that. Nobody in Liberia ever dies of natural causes. They're always witched. That's that whole thing. So when a few days after she was born, there was an old man that came to the house, and he peered into her crib, and he said, "Ma ne pikina izeo," and that's Liberian English for sort of "this child will be great." For the rest of her life, she's sort of been dogged by that phrase, you know, "Ma ne pikina izeo." every time she when she did something that didn't seem quite so great. So her family did that to her a lot when they were making fun of her.
And the book is really aptly titled. She had a very extraordinary life, and it was difficult at times. And one of the things that struck me was that it didn't always follow, I guess, this roadmap of what you would think of as a future president. For instance, she was married when she was 17. And frankly, the man she married was not a kind man. He was not a supportive man. Could you talk to me about that part of her life when she was married, while she was raising her sons and trying to go to school?
She was married at 17, as you say, which is extraordinarily young. And then she had started having children immediately. And she was married to Doc Sirleaf, who was a very rigid guy. He'd gone to Tuskegee Military Institute here in the U.S. and had a rigid military bearing. The couple had four children, one after another, four boys. So by the time she was 21, she was a mother of four boys, the youngest one under the age of 1 year old. At that time, Ellen and Doc came to the United States to go to college. And this was a big deal for her to be leaving her boys. She left them with their grandmothers, but still it was a huge source of, I don't want to say tension in the family, but it was more like a source of guilt for her, the idea that she was leaving her boys to go to school. And that's something that she still deals with today. She was here for 2 years. And during that time, her husband started to beat her. That was when the abuse started. He was very abusive. He beat her regularly. He slapped her. He threatened her with a gun. And after the couple eventually moved back to Liberia, she, after a few years, walked out. She began an affair with another man and then walked out.
You talked a little bit about the tension it caused, leaving her sons. How did that decision to go to America in 1962 and then again in 1969 when she went to Harvard, how did that decision affect her relationship with her sons?
It did. It definitely affected mostly her relationship with her youngest son, because he constantly would tell her, "You were never there when I was growing up." She's patched that relationship now, she says. But when you talk to her, and when I talked to her, it was clear to me that she still feels there's a lot of emotional baggage that she still carries around. And in some ways, it's interesting because one of her blind spots to this day, what she's criticized about, is that she's appointed her sons to high positions in the Liberian government and that's has dealt with charges of nepotism. And I think she has this blind spot when it comes to them that is rooted in the fact that she left them when they were young.
So we talked about that being a tough decision to leave her sons, but how did that decision help her career?
Well, she got to go to college.
Right.
I mean, so that's it was either stay in Liberia and raise children, or it was move to the United States, first go to Madison Business College, where she got her associate's degree, and then she went to Denver, where she was able to get her bachelor's, and then she went to Harvard, where she got her master's. And that sort of put her in a, you know, in a bureaucratic, at least, great light when she was competing for president, but it also set her on a way as a career woman in the 1960s era Liberia, which was a big deal. When she came back, she got a job at the Treasury Department, which became the Ministry of Finance, dealing with numbers, which is, you can imagine, is an area that you don't have women steeped in, especially not Liberian women. And she was, you know, very often the only woman in the room.
And something that struck me was how brave she seemed, or how brave she is. In the book, you even have a chapter called Big Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout her life, it kind of seemed like her big mouth, if you want to say, got her into trouble, but it also propelled her into the presidency. She publicly spoke out against several Liberian presidents, sometimes while working for the Liberian government. How did that help her rise through her ranks? How did that come back to kind of bite her later on? And what do you think sort of drove her to speak out, even in times where it may not have been the best thing for her?
Well, it definitely, I don't think it helped her rise through the ranks, but it definitely helped her, you know, when the government was overthrown. She had a huge mouth, and she was very good at biting the hand that fed her. She would constantly go and make these speeches and complain about corruption in the Liberian government. And this was the same government that she was working for, and she would get in trouble for that. And, you know, the men who ran the Ministry of Finance never liked that. And then she would come back to the States and sort of cool her heels a little bit until the furor died down, and then go back to Liberia again. surprisingly, though, once the military coup happened, you know, that criticism sort of inoculated her, because 13 of her colleagues in the Liberian government were executed on the beach by a firing squad. She was not, in part because she was a woman, but also because she had been, she was seen as a vocal critic of the government.
And when she worked for the government, she sometimes worked under brutal, violent dictators. She worked for Samuel Doe, who later threw her in jail, and she was an early supporter of Charles Taylor, her presidential predecessor, who was later charged with war crimes. I'm wondering, how does she reflect on those decisions to work and support these men who did terrible things to the Liberian people?
You're asking a really good question now, because you're touching on one of the fundamental contradictions of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She is a political animal in many ways. She can be very inspiring, but she has spent her life making political compromises. And she is willing to work with different sorts of people who you might not necessarily be willing to work with. The Samuel Doe thing, I mean, this is a guy who came to power, killed her boss, the president, executed all her friends and colleagues on the beach by a firing squad, and then told her that he wanted her to be his, you know, the country's chief banker. And she took the job, partly because she convinced herself that, you know, the original system, the class system in Liberia that the military had just did the coup over, was unfair to begin with. And she thought, maybe on the inside, you know, they've gotten the killing out of the way, maybe I can help them from the inside. That didn't work. You know, a few months later, she quit and moved to the U.S. because they were immediately very corrupt as well. But she thought she could work with him at first. The Taylor part is more interesting, even if you can imagine that. But like many Liberians who hated Doe, when Taylor first invaded Liberia, people were so happy at the idea that they were going to be getting, that he was fighting Doe, that they threw their lot behind him without trying to find out what kind of man he was. And she was definitely one of those. She was part of a Liberian group here in the U.S. that gave Taylor $10,000. She advocated on his behalf. And then it came out a few months later that he was as bad as Doe. I mean, his troops were raping and pillaging throughout the country. He started the whole child soldier where the children were kidnapped from their mothers. He was deplorable, and it was at that point that she cut her ties with him and kind of denounced him. But that initial support of Charles Taylor haunts her to this day.
I want to go back a little and talk about her time in jail. She was thrown in a jail cell by Samuel Doe and later charged with sedition. But it was something that sort of propelled her into being a hero, and a hero especially for women, and it sparked a movement. Could you talk about that and how the experience of being incarcerated affected her, and how it also kind of galvanized the women behind her?
In 1985, she was thrown into a cell at Shefflin Barracks after a failed coup that she had taken no part in. And the first night in that cell, there was a young Gio girl who had been gang raped by soldiers, who was thrown in the cell with her. And Ellen comforted the girl, and, you know, the two of them were together that night. She was bleeding. She was crying. It was a horrific, horrific night for Ellen. And that sort of, in many ways, helped to galvanize the women's movement in Liberia, at least as far as Ellen was, because to this day, she never saw the girl again, but she still talks about her and what she had gone through that night and what so many other Liberian women had gone through and went through during the war. At the same time, the fact that they had thrown this woman, meaning Ellen, a political dissident, into this jail cell helped to galvanize the women's movement in Liberia, because women were outraged at the idea that they had put this woman in jail.
Rape and violence figures prominently in this book. You wrote about your mother being raped during the Liberian Civil War in your memoir, The House at Sugar Beach. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was moved by the experiences of the women that she met, but the women were also moved by their own experiences, and it was one of the reasons why so many of them got behind Ellen Johnson Sirleaf when she ran for president.
I think the prevalence of rape in Liberia did a lot to help Ellen Johnson Sirleaf get elected, because after the Civil War, you know, 70% of the women in Liberia had been raped and carried the scars of it. So many other women, as I mentioned earlier, had seen their children kidnapped and turned into child soldiers. So much of the civilian population had been preyed upon. It wasn't a war of just army versus army. It was a war of all of these armies preying on the civilian population, and in particular the women. And they had been through hell. And they decided almost cumulatively in 2005 that they weren't going to put up with this anymore, and the only way they were going to get out of this was to vote a woman president, because they believed, you know, a woman wouldn't go back to war. And that's what largely dragged Ellen to the presidency.
Helene Cooper is a journalist for the New York Times. Her latest book, Madam President, chronicles the life of Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. You're listening to a special edition of Midday. Our conversation is recorded today, so we're not taking calls, but you are welcome to leave your comments on the WYPR Facebook page. More with Helene when we return. Welcome back to this Midday Special Edition. I'm Bridget Armstrong, filling in for Tom Hall. Coming up later in the program, I'll speak with feminist writer Roxane Gay about her latest collection of short stories, Difficult Women, and her upcoming memoir, Hunger. And tomorrow, guest host Kathleen Cahill talks about the global refugee crisis with Bill Frelick of Human Rights Watch and Mary Elena Hincapie of the National Immigration Law Center. If you're just joining us today, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Helene Cooper. We're talking about her latest book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. President Johnson Sirleaf made history when she became the first woman elected to lead an African nation. Our conversation is recorded today, so we're not taking calls, but you are welcome to visit WYPR's Facebook page and join the discussion. So in 2005, she announced she would run for president, but this was after a failed run in 1997 against Charles Taylor. Surprisingly, Charles Taylor won. And that was one of the things that was really interesting to me in the book. I couldn't understand, after everything that the people had been taken through, why people were in such support of Charles Taylor.
You and me both. To this day, I don't understand it. It was stunning because, you know, one of the campaign models that became attached to Charles Taylor was, he killed my ma, he killed my pa, but I'll vote for him anyway. It was stunning. I mean, to this day, Charles Taylor still has a lot of supporters in Liberia, not a majority, but he still has plenty of supporters. But the fact that he won the election in 1997, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf ran against him and complained that the elections were fixed, but the reality was Charles Taylor won. I mean, he had an overwhelming percentage of the vote. The closest I can come to making sense of it was, there was a belief among a lot of people that he had broken Liberia, let him fix it. He had invaded, you know, 7 years before, just as he was about to, he run over most of the country, and just as he was about to take over Monrovia, international peacekeepers came and stopped him. And so there was a belief among some people that he had been stopped by the international community from winning it outright, fair and square, and just let him have it. But I don't understand it either, and I've spent decades looking into the why of that.
So after Ellen Johnson Sirleaf lost to Taylor, it sort of seemed like it kind of propelled her to fight against him even more. I mean, this is before she even decided that she was going to run for president again in 2005. She was really working kind of against him.
Very much so. I mean, I call that chapter of Hell and Fury, because it very much reminds me of the Hell Hath No Fury, you know, like a woman scorned. She had lost to him, and so then she went and worked very hard to completely discredit him internationally. And he gave her a lot of rope to hang him with, you know, but she used her contacts at the IMF and World Bank to sort of strangle him financially. She used her contacts into the international community and with even the United States government and the State Department to get a travel ban put on him. She made sure the world knew about all of his atrocities. She was on the radio and TV all of the time. She managed to engineer cutting his ties with his few allies, you know, in the African presidential circuit. And she was, you know, she was like one-stop shopping for any journalist who wanted somebody credible to go to and say, how bad is Charles Taylor? Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was there to tell you.
And at the same time, while she was kind of mounting this campaign, the women in Liberia were also mounting their own form of protest. And they put a lot of pressure on Taylor and his regime to go to the UN meetings. Could you talk about that and the movement that the women sparked to get Taylor out?
It was a stunning movement, really. There were these women all over the country in they would wear white T-shirts, and they would kneel in the ground and in the sand and pray. And they were praying for peace, and they continued for months and months and months. They sang, "We shall overcome. and all they wanted was peace. And when Taylor was run out of town by the international community, and George Bush stepped into it, and he was given safe passage into Nigeria, but there were still all these other warlords who were involved, and the women lobbied and lobbied them and harassed them until they were forced to go to Accra for these international peace talks. These women have a whole lot to do with why the war finally ended in Liberia, and then they turned that movement into a movement for Ellen Johnson's relief.
And what's amazing is these are not women who were formally educated. These are not women who previously led in any sort of political way. These were market women. These were women that are some of the poorest women. Could you talk about that and how they were able to kind of use their numbers? And that's how I kind of looked at it. There was this absence of power, this absence of being given a voice, but they took that voice and they used their numbers to do so.
These were the women who, in many ways, carried this country on their backs. They were market women who, during the entirety of the war, continued to make market. They continued to sell their goods on the side of the road. They would go through all these rebel soldiers who attacked them, go to the border, fetch their wares, and bring them back. And this economic entrepreneurial activity by these women largely got the country through the war. And these women figured out that they could turn that economic power into political power, and that's what they did. It's sort of, they were the only ones, what passed for any entrepreneurial activity went through them in Liberia, and they realized that, okay, so we're doing all the work, and we're the ones who're selling the goods on the roads while the men are fighting. We can turn this into a movement that gets a woman elected president.
Right, and that was the thing, that a lot of the women were the only ones working and bringing in food into households.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that and how that kind of changed, I guess, I don't know, the dynamic of the family or the dynamic of who's leading, and that how that later gave those women the voice. And I guess we'll get to it, that the women decided to break some of the rules to get Ellen Johnson Sirleaf elected. But could you kind of talk about how that empowered them as well?
Well, it's definitely a matter of, if you're the one who's doing the work, and if you're the one who's making what little money there is to be made, you're already going to have a small amount of power. Meanwhile, the men are out there fighting. And so these women figured out how to turn that power into political power.
And they often put themselves into danger, even trying to get the things that they sold during the war. You told a story about women who would cross over to the borders and face soldiers, all trying to get something to sell. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, there were men. I mean, these women were going way behind enemy battle lines, and, you know, they were being attacked every single day and every night. There was one woman, Lucy Sloan, who I talked to, who had been going to the Ghanaian border to get market wares to bring back, and she was attacked by Guinean soldiers. She was, at one point, the women were forced to lie down on the ground in the night, thinking that they were about to get killed. There were so many of these stories, though. Everywhere you go, you talk to women who went through this sort of thing.
And so in 2005, when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf decided to run again, she now had this base of women. And she this time was running against a former soccer star, George Weah. It was really interesting, and I felt there were a lot of comparisons to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. In a lot of ways, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was clearly the most qualified candidate, but George Weah had this support from young men who watched him play soccer. He was a very good player, and he had this support, although he didn't really have the experience. Although the support wasn't kind of split along income levels, it was split along gender. She, of course, beat Weah, but there was a battle there. Could you talk about what some of the women did to ensure that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf would be the next president?
The women were outraged at the idea that a football player was going to try to go up against a Harvard-educated global bureaucrat who, in their view, had so much experience to put this war-shattered country back together again. The men, meanwhile, all of the male presidential candidates who hadn't made it to the runoff, all threw their hats behind George Weah, with the exception of one, all of the main ones. And then they accused the women of being sexist. But the women didn't care. And so they were willing to fight the men with the same kind of dirty tactics that the men used, you know, except they found an even more imaginative way to do it. You know, they stole I talked to women who stole their son's voter ID cards. One who went into her son's bedroom in the middle of the night, took his ID card and buried it in the yard so when he showed up at the poll, he wouldn't be able to vote. There were women who, like, enticed the men to buy their voter ID cards and tricked them into selling it to them. There were women who passed babies around because if you were a nursing mother, you could cut to the front of the line, so they're passing the same baby around to the front of the line on election day. They were willing to do anything they could. They thought they needed to get her elected.
So she was elected in 2005. This was following a runoff election, so it wasn't as clear cut, and it was, I can imagine the tension and kind of the build up and the anticipation there. She won in 2005, took office in 2006, and she's been in office since then. Liberian elections are coming up in October, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is not going to be on the ballot. She's stepping down.
Which is amazing for Africa, because, you know, we don't step down until we put a bullet in our head.
Right. I was going to say that she's not going to step down because of a coup. She's not going to be. It's not going to be because she was overthrown. This is the first time this has happened in decades. What do you think her legacy will be in Liberia? Has her presidency empowered women? I mean, when President Barack Obama was elected, a lot of people were hopeful that it would improve race relations, that it would improve the state for African Americans. And I'm just wondering if that was the hope for women in Liberia and if that hope has kind of come true.
That was definitely the hope for women in Liberia, much in the same way as President Obama's presidency. There was some disappointment that it doesn't seem to have materially affected race relations here in the United States. There is also some disappointment that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's presidency may not have materially affected gender relations in Liberia. There's no doubt at all that women in Liberia are more empowered now. They certainly, you go into elementary schools and you'll see young girls who say they can be president. There are plenty of women in the government. At the same time, though, you know, it's been a hard road for her to hold. She's been accused of, you know, there has been a lot of corruption in her government. There's the nepotism issue with her sons. Liberia still is lagging in education and public health. But at the same time, she's allowed freedom of speech and freedom of press in a way we've never had in Liberia before. People are willing to criticize the government without getting thrown into jail. And I think that freedom of speech helped Liberia to come out of the Ebola crisis that we went through in 2014 far sooner than either Sierra Leone or Guinea, which were not hit as hard as Monrovia was. But the Liberians during Ebola went crazy. They were so angry at the government when this happened, and they were complaining on the radio and on TV, and the government acted because it was responding to citizens. So you didn't see that in either Guinea or Sierra Leone. And I think that's part of her legacy as well.
Helene Cooper is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent. Her memoir, The House at Sugar Beach, explores her own childhood in Liberia. Her latest book is called Madam President, The Extraordinary Life of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Thank you, Helene, for joining me.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, I'll speak with Roxane Gay about her latest collection of short stories, Difficult Women.